Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
This is your host, Robin Linkart, and today we will be exploring faith, journey, and community with our guest, Robert Cook. Robert Cook is currently serving as the Mission Center President and Financial Officer of Cedar Valley Nauvoo Mission Center. Welcome, Robert. We're glad to have you today.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Robert, why don't you catch us up on your life right now? What's going on in your life? What are you doing? Who are you?
I'm approaching 74 years old. I retired fairly early and have been involved in various stages of Mission Center leadership for about 6 years. I sometimes wonder how I got here and what I'm doing here, but nevertheless, I think I've always seen myself as more of a follower than a leader, but every time I turn around, there's a vacuum somewhere, and I jump into leadership, and I guess it's gotten reasonably comfortable over the years. So I'm here in Nauvoo. Nauvoo has played a very important part in my life. I'm one of those people who moved to Nauvoo deliberately to be able to experience living here.
It is a beautiful place, and every time I come to visit Nauvoo, I think I'm captured in a new and deeper way with all that Nauvoo has to offer us. So, Robert, I understand that you grew up in Community of Christ, and we'd really love to hear a little bit of your story, what that was like for you, how you experienced the church in your early life all the way through to today.
Well, I'm delighted to talk about my early life and the onset reunion grounds in Massachusetts. I often think that I talk too much about onset, so asking me to talk about it is really a delight. I grew up spending summers and the good weekends in the spring and the fall at a small cottage on the Onset Reunion Grounds. Onset Reunion Grounds was originally purchased by the Southern New England District about 105 years ago and quickly became a place where people spent more than just the reunion there. In the early days, they laid out lots for people to put their tents on, and then pretty soon there were cottages. And then when that was, the purchase was in 1911. By the time we got to 1929 and 30 and the years of the Great Depression, many people had no place to live within the outer world and spent a few years in their summer cottages on the Onset Reunion Grounds. So now it has evolved into a community that has about 80 homes, and a couple of dozen of those are full-time residents, maybe more than that. So we have quite a little community that really is bigger than some cities out in this rural part. My family, my father was born 2 years before the reunion grounds was purchased, and he spent his early life there in the summers with his family. And then he went to Graceland in 1929. He fell in love with my mother. They spent a year apart when he moved back to the East Coast and tried to get some money together to be able to get married and live together. They got married in 1930. Somebody by the name of Roy Cheville married them in Shenandoah, Iowa. Then in only about 3 or 4 years after that, they purchased a cottage across from his family cottage. that had a bedroom, a living room, and a kitchen. The plumbing was outside up a lane towards the woods. And then they started having children about 10 years after they were married. Ultimately, there were four of us, and my father had, I have pictures of my father and friends working on additions to the cottage, which now has three bedrooms. Granted, they're small, and an indoor plumbing. And I still have that. None of my siblings were ready to take it when our parents both died, and I took it even though I wasn't sure it was a wise thing, but it's become one of the great pleasures of my life to go back there and be with the people I grew up with. So during the summers when we were there, the rule was very simple. We would have breakfast and Mother would send us out and say, "Don't leave the grounds." And I've sort of thought about that in later years, having a broader significance. And we knew that there were mothers watching us wherever we were, and that it was really one big family. There are several of us who discussed the fact that we've been going to reunions at onset since before we were born. And that, you know, my mother carried me at reunion before I was born. And so all of this is just really home and feels so safe to me. I think as the years have gone on, in some ways, I've been trying to recreate that sense of safeness in my life, and been very interested as I've gone through life in reading about utopian communities and intentional communities, reading academically, and wishing that I could go visit them, but never had really visited one. One in particular, when I was very young, was the Twin Oaks community. I had read Skinner's book, Walden 2, a novel in which he talked about a utopian community. And these people got together and created a community using that as a blueprint. As the years went on, they modified it, which is the nature of community. You you know, there isn't one hard and fast way of doing it. But that community still exists today, and they have some very interesting ways of doing things that have made it successful for them.
So, Robert, as you talk about your life in Onset and the little cottage there and how important that was to your family, and the whole tradition, Community of Christ tradition, which started in the late 1800s of gathering in summertime for reunions where families come together for a week to 10 days to live in community, totally focused on being present with one another and exploring different aspects of our faith together. How did all of that play out in your life as a young disciple and growing up? When you weren't in Onset, did you attend a congregation in your town?
Yes. The place where I went to undergraduate college had an extremely small congregation, but some very faithful people who drove 45 minutes to pick me up and 45 minutes to take me back. And I've always really appreciated the wages of people who did that. And then after I graduated, I ended up in the Chicago area and went to a congregation that was substantially larger. And I was called as to the priesthood as a deacon when I was 16, and then over the years received a call to priest and then to elder in the Lombard congregation in the Chicago area. Reunions were always important to me. And I remember going to a reunion when we were living in the Chicago area in Michigan, when my second son was 2 or 3 weeks old, and we were in a tent, and mm-hmm. it was quite an adventure. But, you know, reunions have, for me, recaptured that sense of community and safety that I felt at ONSA.
So I understand you're really involved with Camp Nauvoo, which is very near, probably 3 minutes drive time from where we're sitting right now this morning talking. Tell us a little bit about your connection with Camp Nauvoo over the time that you've lived in these parts.
When I moved to the Chicago area in probably about 1968, we took a weekend trip to Nauvoo. And at that time, I was in the middle of reading Flanders' book, Kingdom on the Mississippi. And I still remember walking around the streets of Nauvoo during the day and reading his book in the evening in the motel. And that's one of three or four experiences that have changed my life. Another one of those we'll talk about later in one of the communities that I was able to visit in the last couple of years. The next summer we came 2 weekends, the next summer 4 weekends, and you can start to see the progression. Mm-hmm. It took about 5 years before I decided we needed to buy a building of some sort and create a weekend home for us. And we did that. And then about 10 years later, I had been teaching at a college in the Chicago area and was getting very well acquainted with another professor who was a member of the LDS Church. And I got them all excited enough that both of our families left teaching and moved to Nauvoo. And we lived downstairs and they lived upstairs. And it was quite an adventure for us. We had a little bit of consulting work we were doing and kind of kept things together. It lasted 2 or 3 years before I think we were gradually starving to death. and we went off and did other things. But I stayed in Nauvoo probably another 5 years and bought an old hotel that was getting ready, was looking at demolition. But I was able to purchase it and started working on that. And that became a big part of my life over the years, remodeling the hotel and being involved in Nauvoo. And then I think at some point I decided I needed to move to Carthage. I think it was after my divorce. I thought I would move to Carthage for 6 months, and I never came back to Nauvoo full-time. Mm-hmm. So I never have lived here full-time since. But my fascination with Nauvoo and with the history here, and I have some family history in this area that has just kept me constantly involved here. So when I became Mission Center president, actually even before that, when I was only financial officer, I started exploring the need of the people here for better housing connected with the very nice lodge building that we have. And we started a many-year process of talking about how we would do it and getting an architect and going through planning and construction, and we're kind of in the middle of the construction of that project right now. And what I'm finding is that brings me to Nauvoo a day or two a week. And last spring when that started to happen, it just really delighted me. Mm-hmm. to have the time to explore things here in Nauvoo again as I was working on the project at the campground. So I'm all excited about that and looking forward to another couple of years of that construction process and getting more and more deeply into Nauvoo.
Yeah, I've been over there this weekend and exploring the project in process, and it looks really, really exciting. I want to get to talking about some of your recent adventures exploring different expressions of community. But before we go there, I'm really wondering, Robert, if you can tell us a little bit about the Tiny House Project, because I think that's something that's connected to a community and certainly is something, at least in the USA, that folks have been exploring in life not connected necessarily to faith.
That was something that happened halfway accidental. We were planning to build a three-bedroom facility early on to get some experience with construction at Camp Nauvoo and to meet the immediate need. We went through the whole process with that, and ultimately it was too expensive for us to do, and we had to deadline the project. And then I said to the campground board, well, if I built a portable cabin with my own money and bring it here, and you use it for a summer, I'll let you either buy it or I'll take it back to my home where I have a place I could use it. And we did that. And when it arrived, when the portable cabin arrived, many people looked at it and said, oh, that's a tiny house. And that was when things were really heating up on the HG network. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so my wife often will sit there for hours watching tiny house projects and whatever. And so it was so well received the first summer that at the in the middle of reunion week when it was first being used, they wrote me a check, bought it, and said, we want four more.
Wow.
And so now we actually have six of them there, and they continue to be a delight to the people who use them. They have a living room, a small bedroom, and a full-scale bathroom with shower, and a sleeping loft above that will hold four kids. Mm-hmm. And they have just been a big hit. I think about so many other ways we could use them, but we're still in the early stages of all of that. And I don't know whether we will add more of those. There are actually some more interesting things going on in one part of our expansion project that may add some portable buildings that are more historically oriented. Mm-hmm. We have some people who are interested in doing some of that. So this is all exploding.
Yes, and it's so exciting. And I have to say, when I went on the grounds for the first time earlier this month and saw the tiny houses, they are delightful. And they look like little cottages, as you were talking about onset. And I've never been to onset. I was thinking, those tiny houses look like they could even be at onset. Colorfully painted, just really, really nice.
So one of the things that's been very interesting is as I've been dealing more with the people doing archaeology down on the flats and looking at the sizes of the homes they had then, they were tiny houses.
Oh, yeah.
We've come full scale, I think, around.
We do tend to think that we have the new idea, right. And when we study up, we find out those who have lived long before us often had the same idea, just in another time. Mm-hmm. So you've talked a lot about community, growing up in onset, in the context of your faith life with Community of Christ, and how that left such a profound imprint on you and in a very real sense shaped and formed you and your understanding of community and how that is connected with how we live our faith. I understand, Robert, that you had an opportunity to take a trip with Andrew Bolton, who served on the Council of 12 beginning in 2007 and retired officially last year in 2017. 16, and that trip afforded you the opportunity to explore some different expressions of community and profoundly impacted your life. Can you tell us that story?
Well, you're very accurate. I think it was about 3 years ago that Andrew Bolton was the guest minister at one of our two reunions here in Cedar Valley, Nauvoo. And during the week, it started to become clear that that I shared Andrew's passion for intentional communities. I love to hear him talk about the communities that he's worked with, the one that he lived in for a year, and all of that. And he started to hear me talking about trying to get people to spend their weekends on the reunion grounds we were at. And then he started talking to me about his idea to put together what he called a traveling seminar on Zion. His idea was to do a bus trip, sort of like the historic bus trips, but to go to various communities and have opportunities to discuss and learn while we were traveling. So then he's a wonderful organizer and has so many contacts. And he said, how about we do an exploratory trip for a week? And I thought, man, I've died and gone to heaven. I had had this dormant interest for most of my life to explore places like Twin Oaks and others that I was aware of, and had never gotten myself in gear and gone and done it myself. He put together a schedule. We rented a car. We spent a week together. Boy, you really get to know someone.
Yes, you know, yes.
I finally figured out when he wanted to stop to go to the loo what he was talking about. We spent a week. We drove 3,000 miles. Spent a lot of time in the car visiting and discussing our experiences. So do you want me to tell about the trip, the communities that we went to?
Yes, yes. Okay. I think that'd be great.
First of all, we went to the Dancing Rabbit, which is actually only about an hour and a quarter from where we're sitting here in Nauvoo. And it's an ecology-based community. Intentional communities all have some kind of mission, okay? And their mission is to demonstrate that life is good living on 10% of what the resources that the rest of the world lives on. So they're talking about water and electricity and other things. And so, fascinating place. When you walk through it, I just feel like I'm walking through a medieval English village because they don't come in like we do and have the streets east and west and north and south. They just go where nature wants them to go with the streets, and they wander around, and they use all either natural building materials or materials that are reused, that are repurposed for that. The thing that I think interests me as much as their ecology, not that I'm not interested in ecology, I am, is the practices that they have for governing their community, for making life good, their social interactions, and also, although they didn't talk about it until I prompted them, their method of dealing with people who just are not fitting in the community, which is a serious issue. I'm coming more and more to understand how serious that issue is if you're going to put together a community. So all of that was fascinating. And then we headed for Pennsylvania. which is a fair distance. And in Pennsylvania, we visited a Bruderhof community. The Bruderhofs, which is German for brother house or something like that, have a community that we visited that had about 300 people. And this community has existed for a couple of generations. So there were a wide range of people there, young, teenage, middle age, etc. And they have their own community industry so that people are able to work in the community. Their housing is interesting, but the basic thing that they have been able to achieve is that they literally have all things in common. They do not own private property. When they need clothes, they go to the community clothes place and they check out what they need, and it's their stewardship to take care of those clothes while they're using them. When they no longer are using them, they turn them back in and take whatever new they need. And it's that way with all of the other stuff. And in a way, when I was sitting at the community lunch meal, it felt an awful lot like reunions. And I remember sitting next to this man who told me about his journey going through a couple of different denominations and ultimately coming to the Bruderhof. And that was all very interesting. But at the very end, when sort of took a deep breath and sat back for a minute, he said, you know, the money part, that is bringing all of your resources into community and committing to it, he says, that's the easy part. He said, the hard part is learning how to interact with the people. And I thought, okay, yes. One of the things I enjoyed greatly at the Bruderhof community was the hour or two I spent in the morning. They put Andrew and I down at two different workstations, and I was assembling. I had this really interesting screw gun and was assembling these parts that were going into one of their industrial products, which is assistive chairs for handicapped people. And I just really enjoyed that. It made me somehow feel connected, feel like I was worthwhile, feel, you know, and everybody everybody seemed to be having a good time, I guess is the best way to express it. There weren't people running around with long faces. They were all having a good time.
So how many hours out of a day would someone living at Bruderhof spend engaged in productive work like you describe you and Andrew doing?
I think typically about the normal 40-hour week. But one of the interesting things is that there were older people who obviously would not be able to participate in any kind of workforce out in the world, who would come in and work for a few hours.
And they had children there too?
Oh yeah. Andrew and I went for breakfast with the host. We were only there less than 24 hours. But when we got up in the morning, we were taken to breakfast with a host family. And one of the family was a disabled adult child. Very interesting. And Andrew and the host knew some people in common from when he had lived in a Bruderhof community in England. But, you know, without anybody saying anything, it dawned on me near the end of the conversation that while they were talking about the people they knew, there was never a negative comment. They talked about all the positive things about people. And then later on, Andrew shared with me their rule of silence, which is just very biblical. It's, you know, you don't say negative things about people you love, whether it's in their presence or not. And Andrew talks about his experience with people resolving issues directly with the person that they have the issue with. He has a very colorful story about that. And so that was one of three or four pivotal experiences in my life in less than 24 hours, and I went away from there saying, you know, all of the stuff we're doing with social ministries is really dealing with symptoms of the fact that we don't live in a Christian community. Because in that community, young couples could never fight about money because there wasn't any money. There were no unemployed. All of your health needs are taken care of, all of, you know, all the way from birth to death. They have their own graveyard and, you know, very nicely taken care of. And it was just, it took me to the place of understanding that our problem is we don't live in a Christian community. It's not a problem of except for the fact that we live in a culture that is sick, that produces bad things, and then we try to fix them. It is possible to live in a Christian community and to not produce all those kinds of problems. They don't spend money on a police force because they don't need it. And they do spend, you know, I've had people say, well, isn't that very ingrown and very isolated to do that? But they actually travel. They have about 20 communities scattered around the world, and they do a lot of traveling from one to another, which gives them broader exposure to their own culture, and they spend a lot of time doing mission trips to deal with things that problems we have created on the outside world. So they really are not what many people would suspect as ingrown.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. So you were in Bruderhof for, you say, not quite 24 hours, and then you were on down the road. Where did you go next?
Next we traveled another long trip to Georgia, to the Koinonia community. Koinonia was an extremely small community that had, I don't think, ever been very large, but way back in the, I think, the 40s or 50s, it was put together to by a number of people to try to demonstrate that people of all races and skin colors could work together side by side. Ultimately, the surrounding people in Georgia attempted to destroy the community by isolating it and preventing them from earning enough money to subsist, etc. And they were able to find a way to get through that. One of the things that, despite the fact of how small it is, one of the things that is very well known that came out of the Koinonia community is the Habitat for Humanity. And so Andrew says it's a demonstration of how a small group can have a big impact.
How long did you stay at Koinonia?
Again, about 24 hours. We stayed overnight. We walked around the community. We visited with a number of people. But again, there wasn't a large dining hall. We did eat with them, but it wasn't anything like the Bruderhof, which is such a large operation with respect to intentional communities.
So when I saw you, Robert, after you went on this journey with Andrew, there was a noticeable change in you. And as you talked about your experience and how it had impacted your understanding of community and the capacity of community and what it can look like to live in community, it just seemed incredibly powerful to me. I would really love it if you could share a little bit of the insights and illuminations that you experienced.
Well, one thing I haven't mentioned about the Bruderhof experience was it was indeed enlightening, and it enthused me. I said, you know, my own denomination believes so strongly in this, but is a little afraid to venture because of, you know, an experience that... a number of experiences where the outside world really beat us up pretty bad over being together. And so, but I looked at the Bruderhof and said, you know, we could do this if we got beyond our fears. But there was one thing that, as I thought about it, I don't know if it was on the trip or when I got home, this profound sadness settled on me. And the sadness was that as I looked at my life, I have worked hard to do what I thought was my calling and my responsibility in the culture I live in, and have been acceptably successful about that. You know, I live a comfortable life in retirement. I have the time and usually the money to do things I want to do. My family is safe and secure, and I thought I had done the right thing. But what I realized after being with the Bruderhof is that I'm so shackled by the world I live in, that I have bought into, that I can't leave it without harming so many people and go and live with the Bruderhof or in a community like that. And so I was just profoundly sad. And as I've talked to other people, and maybe we'll talk later about Andrew's class at reunion subsequent to that, I realize that they all suffer from the same thing. They say, well, this is great, but we couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, ultimately, as I've just recently visited in Onset and also was there for reunion with Andrew, I'm starting to get this total impact of the fact that the people at Onset that all live together have a resource that other people feel is beyond them. You know, we've always heard people who come in, appointees who would come in for reunions would always end up saying, you don't realize what a wonderful opportunity you have here, and would encourage us to move forward. People would shake their heads and say, that was a wonderful sermon, and just move on and just live together, but not with a clear intent, a clear mission. So there are starting to be people at Onset who really were inspired by what Andrew presented last summer and are starting to talk about some things that may actually start to build a community which is more Christian in the way it operates.
So you talked about Andrew's class at reunion. Tell us about that.
Well, part of what, you know, in our talking and everything else, one of the things that on the trip, one of the things that Andrew suggested was that he could do a reunion class on real life intentional communities. And so he put together this delightful class that doesn't just present the communities, but starts out talking about the Book of Acts and the Beatitudes and the foundational things about communities, and then ultimately moves on to talking about what we've done in the Restoration and then into modern day communities. One of the things that really hit the people at onset was when he presented this rule of silence that the Bruderhof use, and people there are feel deeply the fact that gossiping and backbiting is present and drags the community down. And when they saw that and heard about it, it made an impact. And I think, you know, this has created fertile ground for starting to do something that is closer to what we were intended to do.
Mm-hmm. So has that caused a ripple in the Camp Nauvoo membership, friends of the camp, people who have been exposed to that class or to these ideas?
The people mostly said, well, that's great, but we can't do it. And so that's one of my current frustrations.
Ah.
I tried to get some people together to do a field trip to an open house at the Dancing Rabbit and got no responses.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized that. And there's been some discussion with Locke about the possibility of getting the summer interns to take a trip there and see a community like that in action, because those interns tend to have their own summer community here.
Mm-hmm.
As they live together and work together and study together. And I think there's a better chance of us getting that age of people who haven't yet committed to their life's journey, and to get them excited about the possibilities. It's very clear that we have the facilities at Camp Nauvoo to host at least a summer community, and I really would like to move in that direction as the facilities increase and improve. We are going to need to be doing something with it that is not just running housing, but that expresses what we believe about hospitality and about community. And so I'm hoping the opportunities will come over the next couple of years to see if we can put something together that does that.
Yeah, you're really touching on a lot of key points, I think, one of which is part of our stewardship and community of Christ is that everything we're connected with, which would include our buildings, our campgrounds, our historic sites, become a tangible sign, signal, expression of who it is we say that we are, and that we're modeling the authentic sense of community that Jesus taught, and asking ourselves that question, what does that look like in the 21st century? How can we shape and form that in a way that we truly are a reflection of God's boundless love and grace for all people?
Mm-hmm.
I also want to just kind of give a little context for some of our listeners. Robert is referring to Locke Mackay, who is an apostle serving on the Council of 12, but also is the director for historic sites. Locke lives here in Nauvoo, and Community of Christ owns and operates the Joseph Smith Historic Site here in Nauvoo. The LDS Church also has a large presence and owns a lot of historic property in Nauvoo. In summertime, I guess May through October or May through September are just busy time with people coming from all over to tour these sites, which are important to so many expressions of restoration heritage. And with that comes an opportunity to interact with folks. I'm really interested in your living together with an LDS family here in Nauvoo and tasting a sense of community from two very different but woven together in the roots of our heritage expressions of faith, I think. And that you did that successfully for, what, 3 years or so?
At least two, maybe three.
So that's awesome. So, Robert, one of the things I want to ask you is, as you reflect on your experiences throughout your life and more recently, how this journey across the country to visit Dancing Rabbit and Bruderhof and Koinonia in three different states, what that brought to your deepening understanding of community, what are some of the key questions that you think we should be asking ourselves?
Well, I'll take that in a slightly different direction and say that a lot of people talk about the name change in our church. I am very deeply impressed by the fact that our name is Community of Christ, and that just says so much to me. But given my background that I've talked about, and when I read the Revelations, and the Revelations are extremely important to me, I came to a point in my life where I realized that if there was one thing that kept me committed to this church, it was continuing Revelation. I think that is important. As I read those Revelations, they speak to me about the fact that we are supposed to be doing community, and that we are afraid of it, and that we need to move beyond that fear. And I struggled greatly throughout my earlier life with the transition from thinking about Zion as more of a place to thinking about Zion as something that I couldn't put my hands on, that I couldn't, didn't seem to have the real foundation that I experienced at onset and that I thought happened here in Nauvoo. So the frustration that I felt about what I think is necessary for the highest level of community, which is actually living together, not living in different towns and spending an hour on Sunday together. Mm-hmm. That just really, I mean, as good as that can be, to have a family that you, a church family that you spend time together with every week, it doesn't give you the kind of thing that real community does. And when I read the Revelations, they talk to me very loudly about real community. Not everybody else reads them that way, but I do. And going back and looking at them in that light is very interesting. I think in many senses, even our prophet may not have understood the deeper meaning of what the Lord sent through him.
That's
very challenging, I know.
Yes,
in many ways.
Indeed. I think as I listen to you, one of the questions that emerges for me, and it's a question I've had to ask myself and wrestle with in different parts of my journey, and that I think we as Community of Christ wrestle with, and I will speak to the USA context, I think, in the USA, and that is the question, what are we afraid of? Mm-hmm. What is holding us back? Mm-hmm. We capture glimpses of God's vision. We taste Zion. We taste the kingdom of God. Certainly, our camping tradition and reunion every summer gives us an opportunity to practice living that, and yet there are places and portions of our lives that are held back, in a sense.
One of the things I've come to realize just very recently is how important it is, if you're going to live in a real Christian community, that you have implicit trust of your brothers and sisters, that you know that they want your welfare as well as theirs. If you're suspicious of your brothers and sisters, it won't work. So the question of how we get to that level of trust is really important, because I think that's the thing we fear more than the outside world coming at us again the way they did in the 1800s. We fear the other people.
Yes.
And then I go back and say, didn't Jesus say something about dying and being reborn as a new and different person? It would take a total shift.
Yeah.
And we talk about that with respect to baptism and confirmation. It's all there.
Mm-hmm.
We just get ourselves inoculated against the meaning as we talk about the words, and it's all there.
Well, you certainly are bringing us in to a deeper understanding of community and how it is so connected with our understanding of Jesus, and how Jesus taught us to be and to love one another, which at times sounds simple. Mm-hmm. And may indeed be simple, but is certainly not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And is profoundly transforming, especially the deeper we're willing to go into that new birth, as you say.
In a way, I think what we're missing, if this is a course, we're missing the lab component.
The laboratory yes.
component, that is, we should be attempting to practice the things we preach in a way where we can learn and correct and develop in real experiences instead of just talking about them. Nobody would expect that they ended up with a good course in swimming if they only studied about it.
Indeed. At some point, we have to get in the water, don't we? So, Robert, I want to ask you a couple more questions before we wind this up for today. And one is there anything that you wanted to share about and I didn't ask you a question that gave you opportunity to share about that?
I think we covered about everything. We didn't talk about Twin Oaks, though, which was the community that I had been familiar with the longest and came out of patterning themselves after Skinner's Walden II. It was kind of interesting because when we were at Koinonia and Andrew was asking the people how, you know, whether they did anything together with Twin Oaks, the response was, no, some things, but they're a little too hippie-ish for us. Well, I could tell a story, but I'll let that pass. But anyway, when we were at Twin Oaks, the person who guided us a bit through it, at one point when we were sitting down and just discussing things in a very loose manner, he said, you know, you people spend your whole life earning money to buy things that you don't use.
Mm.
And I felt very condemned.
I'm sure many of us feel that.
And so in most of these communities, they report their annual income for tax purposes as a whole community. There is actually another, like 501c3 there. I think there's a 501d that allows them to report their income that way. And the typical income is in the $10,000 to $15,000 range, sometimes less than $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
And they live on that, and they say they have everything they need. And one thing that's typical of these communities is having a carpool and not having individual vehicles. When they do things together, it just works so much better.
That certainly does seem to be a common characteristic of community, is that we can do so much more together than we can as one. And also, we can use so far less together as we might as one, or might think we need as one. So, Robert, the other question I have for you is, you've mentioned a couple books, Walden 2 and Kingdom on the Mississippi, as you came to Nauvoo and explored Nauvoo. Are there other books or resources that you might recommend to our listeners if they want to go deeper in their understanding of community?
I picked up a book when I was at the Bruderhof community that was written by Emmy Arnold, who is the wife of Eberhard Arnold, who was the prime mover in creating the Bruderhof communities. By the way, they are one of the Anabaptist churches, which includes the Amish, the Mennonites, the Hutterites, which are much more like the Bruderhof, and the Bruderhof. And the Bruderhof didn't come into existence until after World War One, when they arose out of all of the turmoil and difficulties and disappointments that came with World War One. And there were a lot of movements of young people trying to figure a better way to live, and it came out of that. And then they joined with the Hutterites for quite a while. The Hutterites and the Bruderhof have been close together, sometimes joined, sometimes just walking side by side. And so this book by Eberhard's wife, Emmy, was very interesting description of the way the group originated because of the difficulties involved that got people thinking about a better way, and also all of the difficulties they went through. No normal person would have persisted the way the Eberhards did, and it's created this wonderful thing for, they have 20 communities with many, probably tens of thousands of people living this way.
That sounds fascinating. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us here today on Project Design Podcast. Those of you who found Robert to be an intriguing person, you can also catch him on our panel response, Who is Jesus to Me?, that we did a few weeks ago, and he talks about who Jesus is to him. Well, I hope you have a great day today. We're early in the morning here in Nauvoo, and it's Sunday morning, and we will be joining over at Camp Nauvoo in just a couple hours for our morning worship and an amazing lunch, followed by Mission Center Conference with our business session and interactions and living one aspect of what it means to be community in community of Christ. So thanks again, Robert.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I always feel like I'm going too far when sitting down for this length of time. Has been a real joy.
This is Robin Linkhart, and you are listening to Project Zion Podcast. Goodbye, everyone, and we'll see you on our next episode of Project Zion.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.